Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. Welcome back to the program. Today, we're joined on the line by none other than Dr. Walter Block, the professor of economics at Loyola University, whose website is walterblock.com. He's been a previous guest on this podcast a couple of times in the past, so I'll invite listeners to check out the archives for our previous conversations with Dr. Block. And of course, many of his writings and interviews and the like are widely available online, so I hope you'll check that out as well. Dr. Block, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us tonight.
My pleasure, always.
Excellent. Well, now, Dr. Block, I want to talk about a scourge that has really plagued the United States and, of course, every nation around the world for decades now, and it is one that claims the lives of upwards of 40,000 people a year in the United States, although that number has declined somewhat in recent years, but still a number that absolutely puts even events like 9/11 in pales insignificance in comparison, just in terms of the number of lives that are claimed every year. I'm not talking about the terrorist threat. I'm not talking about some threat from some menacing foreign power. I am talking about the threat that is posed to people's lives every single day that they simply drive on the roads. This is something that is not on the public policy radar at all, as you've noted before in your own writings, including your book, The Privatization of Roads and Highways. But it is certainly a subject that should be on people's radar, because it is something that, again, is largely preventable. And there are things that we can do to actually prevent this, but unfortunately not within the current rubric of government-run roads and highways. This is a pretty large topic to start, but perhaps we can start from that point, talking about the significance of this topic and why it is excluded from public policy debates these days.
Well, I think you hardly have to interview me. You've said it so well yourself, but I'm glad that you're interviewing me anyway. I did write a book on that, and I've thought about it, but you're a very good student of this as well. Why is it not on the radar? That's really a good question. I guess it's because it's sort of like death and taxes. It seems as inevitable. It's sort of like when you die from old age, nobody says, well, you know, people shouldn't die at 90 or 100 or 88 or something like that. It's just sort of natural. Nobody, and even I, wouldn't say, well, no, I'm not sure about that. I think it's all the government's fault, and people probably would live longer if it weren't for the government. But apart from that, I think it's because people see it as inevitable. Only the government can have roads. And yes, we can tweak and we can push and pull and, you know, maybe do this a little bit better or that a little bit better. And maybe we'll save 100 lives a year out of roughly 40,000. Although, as you say, in the last few years, it's fallen a little bit. But I think the average over the last 10 or 12 years has been about 40,000 deaths a year. And the reason it's not on the news, well, one reason it's not on the news is because the news is controlled by the major media, and the major media are not really free enterprise oriented, but even the libertarian media. I don't know, Ron Paul, say he's got a new TV show, or not TV, but blog show or whatever you call it. And it's just seemed as so inevitable. And also, everyone has the idea that government has always run roads, and which is not true. And therefore, any radical libertarian idea that we should have competing road owners and they would each struggle to make their roads safer, and they would advertise, hey, look, we cut our death rate by 20% last month, you know, come to our road or something like that. It's just not on the public radar, and I think those are the reasons.
Well, I think you're very right about that in that assessment, and it is something that really needs to be looked at precisely because there is such a mental block among people's imagination about the possibility of this being done in any other way, to the point where it has become the standard knee-jerk reaction to anyone proposing free market solutions to the problems that are facing us. But what about the roads? It's almost a standard cliched response, because it's almost inconceivable for people that the roads could be provided by anything other than government services. But as you point out, in fact, the idea that roads have always been provided by government is itself not true. Let's talk a little bit about the origins of roads back, say, in the 19th century, before governments really started to monopolize that venture. Let's talk about how they were provided in the past.
Well, you're quite right, and it even goes past the 19th century. My research shows that even in England in like the 8th of the 9th century, there were turnpike roads. Certainly in Revolutionary War times and before the 1776, there were private turnpike roads. Somebody would get up on his hind legs and make a road between A and B and then start charging people. They would amass the land, and there was a turnpike road. You didn't have any tar. You didn't have cement, obviously. It was just dirt roads. But what they would do is they would charge based on the width of the wagon wheel. If the wagon wheel was very narrow, think ice skates, they would charge more because you'd put ruts in the dirt road and was always given to, you know, flooding or whatever. Whereas if you had a wider wheel, think steam roller, you know, you would flatten out the ruts in the road and they would charge you less because you were sort of helping the road. And they would charge more for two axles than one axle and based on the number of horses. Namely, it was a rational enterprise. You know, it was 200 or 300 years ago, so you're not going to expect anything modern. But we had private roads. And it was a viable system, except what happened was that the police, which was the monopoly police, refused to protect the road owners against the claim jumpers or people who would try to avoid the payments. And obviously it couldn't be viable if the police who seize a monopoly of this and then refuse to protect private property rights. So then the government took over all the roads. But the idea, you're quite right that when libertarians try to convert people to libertarianism, non-libertarians, one of the first objections will say, well, how about the roads and the highways and the streets? You can't do that by private enterprise. It must be a government thing. It's always been government. It hasn't. History shows that we've had private roads, which were viable commercial activities, and presumably they would be competing. Now, I don't know how they would. I don't know that there'd be much of a death rate with horses, although some, but nothing like with cars. I mean, horses go 10, 12, 15 miles an hour. Cars go 70, 80, 90 miles an hour. So obviously there'd be more deaths. But I imagine that there was some sort of competition and you know, try to make a better road and you know, fill in the potholes and fill in the ruts. And it was a viable enterprise. People have this prejudice against long, thin things like roads. But also, sewage lines and water lines and electrical lines and telephone wires, when we used to have telephone wires before the advent of cell phones, and all sorts of things like that. And there's this prejudice, not only on roads, but on all long, long, thin things like that, that somehow the government must do it because private enterprise can't. And I think that's also a mistake.
Well, I suppose one of the reasons that people might think that is because of the issue of eminent domain. If you don't have a government that can claim certain territory, then there would be all sorts of people who would have obstructionist points along a roadway that would require a ridiculous bypass. How could that possibly be solved by a free market?
Well, I do devote a big chapter in my book, maybe 30, 40 pages, I forget how long it was, to just that question, do you really need eminent domain? And obviously it's easier if you have eminent domain. Like what city do you live in now? Where are you?
Currently I'm in Okayama in Japan.
Oh, you're in Japan. That's not a good example because I was going to say, you know, like say you're in Chicago or somewhere and I'm in New Orleans and I want to build a road from New Orleans to Chicago. You're not very helpful being in Japan.
Let's pretend I'm in Chicago.
Okay, you're in Chicago and I want to build a road. You want to be my partner and we want to build a road from Chicago to New Orleans, North-South Road. Now, I don't know how many people own land between New Orleans and Chicago, say 100,000 or 500,000 or 1,000,000 people. I don't know, something like that. Now, one way we could do it is we could try to build a road as the crow flies, you know, a vertical road with no curves in it. Although if they're hills, you know, probably you'd want to skirt around the hills, but let's abstract from that problem. And the obvious problem is that there's going to be a holdout. If we want to build the road the way the crow flies, and how wide is the road? Well, let's say it's going to be three lanes north, three lanes south, and there's going to be a median of, 50 feet, and each lane is 10 feet wide, give or take. So we've got like 150 feet wide and about 1,000 miles long. And some guy is going to say, sure, I'll sell you my land, but it's going to be, $1 trillion an acre, or I'm not selling this homestead no matter what you say, forget about it. So the obvious argument is you can't build a road without eminent domain. They call it expropriation in Canada, same sort of a thing. And now it's easy because, if you have a holdout, you just say, okay, look, we, the government, we think that your land is worth so much per acre. That's fair market value, and we're going to pay it whether you like it or not, and you got to get out. So it's very easy to see how the government can do it. But how could a private enterprise do it? Well, there are various ways. One, we could say, okay, we want the road as the crow flies, perfectly straight up and down. But, you could sort of have an arc. It doesn't have to be perfectly straight. If our road deviates by 5 miles or 10 miles or 15 miles, it'd still be a viable road. And the way I illustrate this in the book is I say there might be roads 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, where road 4 is the vertical one, and 1, 2, 3 are a little to the west, and 5, 6, 7 are a little to the east of this vertical road. And now what we could do is we have several ways of proceeding. One, we could buy options to buy land. Namely, we go to Farmer Jones, who's somewhere in Illinois or Missouri or somewhere, and we say, look, Farmer Jones, farmland is worth, $10,000 an acre, and we'd like to buy, 150 feet wide and, a mile long, because that's the way your land is, but we're not sure we want to buy it, but we want to buy an option to buy it. How much would you sell your land to us for? And let's say he says, okay, $10,000 an acre, and they say, oh, well, I'll tell you what, we'll give you $100 an acre, just as an option, so that if we want to exercise that option within a year or two, then we can buy the land. You're obligated to sell us the land at the agreed upon price. So that's one way. And now we have these seven roads, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and we start buying options all over the place. And if we have a holdout, we just go to one of the other routes. Another way is we don't even have to buy options. We can mail a letter to everybody who's got land between New Orleans and Chicago and say, look, we want to build a road, and we've got these seven routes laid out. And if you're lucky enough to get us to use the route that holds your land, well, then, we'll pay double what the farmland is worth, and we'll skirt around cities or whatever. And you guys try to work it out. And, get together, and the first route that gets everyone to agree, will put the road that way. But now suppose you get Cartman, my favorite character on South Park, and Cartman's main contribution to civilization is screw you guys, screw you guys, screw you guys. And suppose Cartman owns some land which goes north-south, rather east-west, so that on any of our seven routes, there's Cartman. What do we do about Cartman? Well, one possibility is we say, look, Cartman, we'll make you a partner. You let us through, and, you're not going to get 1/3 of the value of this whole thing, but we'll give you, a 2% share in the enterprise or something like that. And then much more radically, what I say is, if you really have an obdurate Cartman that doesn't want to be a partner and won't sell under any conditions or wants $1 trillion an inch or something like that, what we can do is tunnel under his land or build a bridge over his land. Now, here we have an objection. The obvious objection is this thing called ad coelum, A-D-C-O-E-L-U-M. I think that's the right spelling. I'm not sure. And the idea here is that if Cartman owns a square mile, he owns land under coming to a point and above going up into the heavens, namely like a cone. Think of an ice cream cone. And Cartman owns land halfway up the ice cream cone, and he owns down to a point and up into the heavens. Well, there are problems with that. And that's the only objection that Cartman could rely on, so that we can't build under or over his land. The problem with that is, first of all, you couldn't have air travel. I mean, if every time somebody went over your house at 30,000 feet, they had to put a dime in your meter, we wouldn't have air travel. Much more serious, this is incompatible with the libertarian doctrine of homesteading. John Locke, Murray Rothbard stress that you get to own land based on mixing your labor with the land. But nobody mixed any labor with 8 miles below them or 800 feet below them or 30,000 feet above them. So this whole idea of ad coelum has to be rejected as non-libertarian. And now we can deal with an obdurate Cartman. We'll dig under his land or build over. Now, if we build over his land, he might object, well, he's not getting the rainfall. So we can't build a solid thing. We have to build one of those grid things where there are like little holes in it so he can get his rain and his sun or whatever for his crops. And if we dig under, how deeply under do we have to dig? Well, the rule would be we have to dig under his land so far under that we don't cave in any of his buildings. So if all he's got is a bunch of corn plants, well, you know, we can come pretty close to the surface. On the other hand, if he's got buildings dug in and with a foundation 5 stories below, well, then we have to go below that. And also, if the land is sort of like Manhattan, where it's a solid rock, we can get pretty close underneath him without caving him in. On the other hand, if it's like New Orleans, which is a swamp, we have to go way below. Otherwise, we'll cave him in. But apart from those things, the expropriation or the eminent domain is not really a telling objection to the libertarian idea of homesteading and massing land. So we don't really need eminent domain.
Well, the thoroughness of your response should give listeners an indication of just how much you've thought about this. And once again, I will direct them to your work on this, the privatization of roads and highways. And there are all sorts of technical issues that we could talk about how tolls would work and how they would be charged and how toll jumpers would be dealt with, etc. All those types of issues, again, are dealt with in some degree of detail in your book. But I also want to point people to an interesting analogy that you use that I'll probably steal from you for future use, where you talk about if directly after the Kitty Hawk experiments, people were asking the Wright brothers about the airline industry and how it would develop in the next 100 years. They could come up with all sorts of questions. How many airlines will there be and what uniforms will the stewardesses wear? Of course, they would not be able to answer those types of questions. So to a certain extent, asking what a free market solution to this or that problem is not necessarily a fair question to ask, because obviously we can only give our very, very partial answers to what would be a solution that would be derived from hundreds of millions of people interacting in a free market. But having said that, of course, one of the things that we introduced this topic with is the question of road safety and the tens of thousands of deaths per year on the roads. How would privatization of roads work towards the reduction of that death toll?
Yeah, that's a very good point, that it's really impossible. We're not central planners. We're free enterprises. We don't know exactly how this is going to be. And you can do that with any industry, shoes or shirts or wristwatches or anything, that if the government has always done it, now we're going to privatize it. And people say, well, exactly how would it work? We have to say we really don't know, but we can speculate. So I speculate, and let's now speculate about safety, because safety really is the major impetus for this. I mean, 40,000 people a year dying, it's just a charnel house. It's horrible. Okay, so let's take a highway. Probably there are more deaths on highways than on little city streets where people go 25 miles an hour. Although I don't have the exact statistics on that. But on the highways, you know, people, the minimum highway speed is 40 miles an hour and the maximum is 70 miles an hour. And most people, if you do 70 on the highway, a three-lane highway, people are going to go right by you. People do 75 and they don't give tickets, which sort of undermines respect for the law, but that's a whole other question. People even go up to 80 without really getting a ticket. You do 85 or 90, you probably will get a ticket. So my guess, my surmise is that maybe it's not speed. Maybe it's the variation in speed, because you've got some people chugging along at 50 miles an hour, you know, little old lady types or old people or, you know, slow pokes. You got other people doing almost 80 miles an hour. That's a divergence of 30, 35 miles an hour. So maybe on my highway, or our highway, since we're partners, New Orleans to Chicago, what we should do, instead of having a minimum of 40 and a maximum of 70, is say on the left lane, everyone has to do 80. And in the middle lane, everybody has to do 70. And in the right lane, everybody has to do 60. And maybe that'll reduce deaths. For all I know, that might do it. The problem is that right now the rules of the road come from Washington, D.C., and there's one size fits all throughout the whole, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from Mexico to Canada. It's all the same. All the national highways are the same. And possibly, if we had this, each lane has to have its own speed limit, and you have to be within 1 mile of, you know, 60, 70, and 80 miles an hour, or 50, 60, and 70, or whatever it is. Now, our road, we might inaugurate 60, 70, and 80. Some other road might do 75, 70, and 65. And another road might do 90, 60, and 30, or whatever. And then we'd have a whole bunch of experiments. You know, even if the states did it rather than the federal government, we'd have at least 50 laboratories, whereas if it was done privately, we'd have several hundred laboratories. The point is that the rules of the road that will minimize deaths are not given to us from on high on tablets or created in Washington, D.C. This is the way every industry – I mean, imagine if computers were run – or cars, or I don't know, whatever, wristwatches were run by Washington, D.C., and everybody had to make the same wristwatch or the same car or the same eyeglass, we'd have very little progress. So we free enterprises have this expectation that if there's competition, we'll get a better product at a lower price. Now, I'm no road expert. Nobody's a road expert because, I mean, there is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the government experts, but they're not really experts in this sort of a thing because there is no competition. So one possibility to save lives might be to have different kinds of speed limits for the different roads. Another one is, and this is all speculative, as we've said before, because we don't have the pipeline to on high. Another possibility is, you know, there'll be somebody who will be doing 65 in the left lane, and everyone wants to do 70 or 75. And in order to get past them, you got to sort of wiggle around through the other two lanes. You got to change lanes. Now, I speculate that that's dangerous. And what we ought to do, or what private enterprises would do, is say that if somebody passes you on the right, you're in trouble. We're going to give you a ticket. Now, there are rules, you know, sometimes there are signs saying, you know, slower traffic, stay to the right, but they don't give you tickets for that. And this should be really a heinous kind of an offense to sit in the left lane and do 65 or 60 when everyone wants to do 70, when 70 is the legal speed limit and most people want to do 75. And you're sitting there, Grandma Duck, doing 60 or 55 or something. And now there's a lot of people trying to get ahead of you. And that could create accidents. Another one. Take a two-lane highway, two lanes going north, two lanes going south. And now there's one truck right behind another, you know, these 18-wheeler trucks. And you know the one behind is going to try to pass the other one. And you know it's going to take them 15 miles to get past, and it's going to take 15 minutes to get past. And you see this, and what you do is you speed up to get ahead of this bottleneck. And that might be dangerous because you might be speeding up to 90 or something. And we ought to have a rule maybe that anytime two trucks are racing and one is creeping up past the other by an inch every 10 minutes or something, the guy on the right should let him get past, and you shouldn't have those bottlenecks. Now, I want to say that, you know, I spoke loosely. I said what we ought to do now, namely what the government ought to do now. That, strictly speaking, is not what I want to say. I don't want to make the government roads run more efficiently. This is what Bob Poole does at his Reason Group. You know, always supposed libertarians trying to be efficiency experts for the state, which is really despicable. What I'm talking about is what private enterprise would do. Now, if some government manager reads my articles or my book or reads or listens to this interview and says, hey, you know, Block is right, let's try this. Well, okay, I'm not going to stop speaking about how private enterprise would work just because the government might become more efficient. But I want to distinguish myself from the reason crowd and the inside the Beltway efficiency experts for the state. Like I think of Milton Friedman. I don't want to be an efficiency expert for the state. I don't want to help the government run their socialist road system more efficiently. On the other hand, I'm not going to shut up and say, well, you know, since they might improve, if I speak about how private enterprise might run it, therefore I shouldn't speak about this. Well, that's a little bit on the other extreme. So that's why I call myself Walter Moderate Block. I'm very moderate here. On the one hand, I'm not shutting up for fear that the government might improve matters, which I think is a little crazy. On the other hand, I'm not helping them, not being an advisor to them with the idea of making them more efficient. What I'm trying to do is make free enterprise, make the case for free enterprise.
A point well taken. Are you familiar with the work of Martin Cassini at equalitystreets.com?
No, I'm not.
I would recommend not only yourself, but of course all the listeners to check it out. It's a really fascinating traffic campaign that's started in the UK, a UK traffic campaigner who's advocating the taking out of all counterproductive traffic controls, including streetlights and the like, which sounds like a crazy idea, except it has actually been implemented in a few municipalities, including Portishead in Somerset in the UK, with surprising results, where everyone before the experiment predicted it would be total anarchy, as in a bad thing, as in the public conception of what anarchy is, that nothing, people wouldn't give right of way and everyone would just be in chaos. And after the experiment, people said it's remarkable how much it's improved traffic congestion and the like. So again, it just goes to show that there are all sorts of ideas out there for how this could be implemented. And you're exactly right, with a number of different experiments in a number of different laboratories, if you will, there will be a consensus emerge as to what is the best way to handle these different types of situations. So I think this is absolutely just an incredibly important subject, and one that does not get very much attention, as we point out. So there's a lot more to say about this. Unfortunately, we don't have an infinite amount of time, so perhaps we'll draw the conversation to a close. But before we do so, you bring up a very interesting point about the way that the private road system of years past was undermined by the monopoly power of the police, refusing, for example, to enforce any laws on these private roads. If we were to achieve a free market society for the roads specifically, wouldn't we face a similar problem again with government monopolies of power refusing to act to enforce rules of the road?
So I would advocate not only private roads, but also I advocate private police. You know, you're safer in Disney World than you are in Audubon Park in New York, in New Orleans, or Central Park in Manhattan. I would say that if we had full free enterprise, where, you know, my motto is if it moves, privatize it. If it doesn't move, privatize it. Privatize everything, because everything either moves or doesn't move. We would also have private police. But we could still say, let's denationalize the roads. Let's get rid of road socialism. And if the police was still there, well, then the police would have the obligation of making sure that the rules of the road of each owner were upheld. Or each road owner would have his own police, like Disney World has their own police. They have private police on Disney World. And if you act obstreperously, you're going to be surrounded by a bunch of ducks and mice and cats or whatever, all packing heat and being very polite to you, not like the city police, and saying, come with us, sir. Well, you know, we could have that sort of a thing on the nation's highways as well.
Excellent point. I know I said I was going to draw the conversation to a close, but this actually does bring up a point that I know we should address, although I don't think it should need to be addressed. But there was always the people out there who will raise the objection that, well, what if we are in this society of free markets and free roads, and there's only one road to this hospital, and someone decides to charge $1 million to travel upon it, and, oh, then people will die because they can't get to the hospital, or they will be forced to pay $1 million. I think this is a juvenile type of argument, but it is one that is always raised in this type of conversation. So what would be the response to that?
Well, let me just say that more than half my book, maybe 40% of it deals with how would it work, and the other 60% deals with objections. There are 25, 30 different objections, and this is certainly one. I call it the blocked-in problem or the blocked-in threat. The way I see it is I buy a house, and now I want to get out onto your road, you dirty rat, you, and you want to charge me $1 million every time I want to get out or in. And now either I have to get a helicopter or I have to become a good pole vaulter to, you know, get over your road or something. See, right now, when you buy a house, what you're going to do is get title insurance, because you don't want someone else to come along and say, hey, the guy who sold you the house, guess what? He didn't really own it. I'm the rightful owner, and get out. And get out of my house. What you're going to do is have title insurance to make sure that the person who is selling you the house is really the owner of it. Well, under a regime of free enterprise and roads, in addition to title insurance, what you'll have is access insurance. Namely, before you build your house on the side of the road, or before you buy a house on the side of the road, you're going to inquire as to the private road owner, what's his policy? Is his policy such that he's going to charge you $1 million every time you want to come in or out, or not? Or is his policy much more reasonable? And I think his policy will be very reasonable, because he wants you to have a house on the side of his road. I mean, if he builds in a road and nobody has houses or factories or car, stores or anything on the side of his road, and nobody uses his road, it's not going to be much of a road. Our road from New Orleans to Chicago, we're going to try to induce people, entice people to, yes, come build on the side of our road, so there'll be more people using our road. We'll be able to charge more. We will then be forced by the marketplace to write a contract with every person who's contiguous to our road, every neighbor, and say that we're not going to charge you any more than anyone else, or whatever the formal contract is. And I'm not lawyer enough to know how we, our road, can be prevented from blockading people into their homes. But I'm sure the lawyers can come up with some contract which will assure everyone that this sort of a thing will not occur.
Well, once again, I mean, insurance is one of those mechanisms that most people don't think about when they think of free market solutions, but is something that already exists, even within the highly socialized system that we live under today, and would be that much more effective in a society where, again, if millions upon millions of people want something to happen, then in a free market society, that thing will happen. It's just a question of figuring out the mechanisms by which it will happen. Well, again, there's a lot more to talk about, as I say, but once again, I'll direct people to your website and, of course, to your book on this subject, and those links will be in the show notes for this interview. So, Dr. Walter Block, always a fascinating conversation, and today was no exception. So thank you once again for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. It's always a pleasure.